Maine's opioid epidemic. Has there been any progress? What more needs to be done? Earlier this month, we learned that Maine's opioid overdose rate appears to be just as high as it was last year, that someone is dying from an opiate overdose on average once a day in Maine. This, despite a new law that limits how doctors prescribe opioids, and despite increased availability of Narcan, an emergency treatment to counteract overdoses. These numbers are discouraging to those in the trenches. They are especially frustrated by the apparent increase in the usage of fentanyl, a powerful synthetic opioid. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss the efforts in Maine to combat the opioid epidemic, what works and what doesn't, the responsibility of the medical community to help, and what needs to happen next. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Opioid abuse has been called the preeminent public health crisis of our time. Here in Maine, even with all hands on deck, doctors, police officers, social workers, and counselors, the situation does not appear to be getting any better. Today we'll learn what's being done and what needs to happen. In the studio with me, Dr. Jonathan Fellers. He is medical director of Maine Medical Center's Integrated Medication Assisted Treatment Program, and he's assistant clinical professor with Tufts University School of Medicine. Michael Soschuk is chief of police for the city of Portland, and Stephen Cotreau is the program manager for the Portland Recovery Community Center. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you concerned that someone you know is addicted to opioids? If so, do you know where to turn for help? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here for this really important discussion. And Dr. Fellers, let's start with some basics. Can you define what an opioid is and how they work on a brain and why they're so addictive? We know heroin is an opioid, but there are others, and oxycodone, but there are others as well, right?
Right. So opiate and opioid are two different terms for these medications. And opiate means it's an alkaloid from the poppy plant. And the poppy plant has been tied with civilization for probably over 6,000 years.
Opium,
exactly. And actually, the name for the plant back in Mesopotamia was the joy plant. So, it's been linked with its known effects for quite a while. And the derivatives from the opium, the sap of the developing seed pods, contains morphine and codeine and another related compound, thebaine. And that's been traditionally called opium, and tinctures of it are laudanum. Those are the natural opiates, and heroin is actually an artificial derivative of morphine, where they acetylate it, which means adding another chemical group to it. And what that does is actually makes it much more addictive. Mm. What it does is it kind of changes its character, so it's more dissolvable in fats. And the biggest fat deposit we kind of have in our body, for the most part, is our brain. Mm-hmm. It's like a big fat blob. And it makes it very soluble, so the heroin goes directly to the brain to have, like, almost immediate effect.
This drug we're hearing about now, the fentanyl, it's
yes.
even more powerful, right?
Well, it's more powerful in the sense that it requires a smaller amount of it to get the same effect. It's so powerful that, you know, just micrograms of some of the derivatives, like the carfentanil in particular, can lead to overdose or death.
Why is it so addictive?
So opiates and opioids, means drugs that act on that same receptor, the mu opioid receptor, but could be artificial. Why they're so addictive is kind of twofold. First, there's the rewarding aspect of them. They hit this part of the brain, the limbic system, the nucleus accumbens, which is a reward circuit. And we've developed this over many years. To achieve survival. And so they hit the same rewarding aspect of the brain and makes us want to do it again because it kind of fools the brain to thinking that this is something that's necessary for survival. And it's able to stimulate it super therapeutically above what natural rewards would be. So natural rewards would be things like food, socializing, sex, things like that. But they're able to stimulate it beyond what that's possible. Then the second aspect of it is with continued use of the drug, what happens is we develop tolerance to it because our bodies always want to maintain homeostasis. And when someone stops using the drug after they've developed tolerance to it, they will enter into a state of withdrawal. And this is a negative reinforcement of it. So it has positive reinforcement, the rewarding aspect, but then negative reinforcement as well. So when people use it a lot and then stop using it, they go into opioid withdrawal, which is quite miserable. And they know that if by just taking a little bit of an opioid, they'll feel better. And that reinforces in a negative way the cycle of addiction.
Chief Soschuk, what are your officers seeing every day? And is what they're seeing the same with law enforcement throughout the state?
Yeah, I believe that it certainly is. And thanks for having us, and thanks for having this topic back on the airwaves again. You know, our officers are seeing the human impacts of statistics and things that we may read about and see in the media. So we're seeing the individuals that are on the street and in their homes, in many cases overdosing, and in many cases dying ultimately. So this is a tragedy unlike any that I've seen in my 20 years of law enforcement, without question.
Well, I'll come back to that question in a second. But, Steve, tell me what you're seeing. Is there a typical profile or pattern of the person who comes to your recovery center?
I would say no, because the addiction is as varied as there are personalities. And addiction also does not discern who you are, where you came from, whether you're rich, whether you're poor. It can affect anybody. So we see just as varied people walking through the door, young, old.
So this is the question I want to pose to all three of you. We have known how terrible these are for a while now. We've been reporting about it. It's not a secret. It's not as though this happened yesterday. Why are people still using? Why is fentanyl becoming more and more common instead of less and less common, Chief?
Well, I think there's two aspects of that question. One would, the question you pose is, why are people still using? I would respond with, why has society not changed the way we're approaching this issue? And we know that this is occurring. We're seeing this occurring daily, certainly in the state of Maine, with one fatality per day. And yet we haven't changed our systems. We haven't changed our approach and our mindset around this. A piece of that will be working with prevention and treatment for those that suffer from substance use disorders. There's no question that we want to work with individuals in that world. We also want to make sure that we're changing systems that just simply don't work. And to me, that speaks to commitment to really addressing this issue. Because you said in the open, all hands are on deck. Well, you listed a bunch of people which all hands are on deck. But I don't think from a political aspect that we are all hands on deck yet. And, you know, we're still having debates in this country. Is this an emergency? And it's hard to believe that they'd be having a debate in D.C. as if, in fact, this is an emergency. Is this a crisis? You read articles today that 64,000 people lost their life to fatal overdoses. In 2016, there's 66,000 people in the city of Portland. So please, somebody tell me that that's not an emergency. We're having a debate. Is Narcan good or is that bad? It's a miracle drug that's saving lives. Why are we debating whether or not that's an effective tool or not? So I think we've got a long ways to go in that regard. And that's I could say that I've got team members here because we do these talks on a regular basis, and there's a lot of good people out there that are fighting to change these systems and really to hope to save lives. I mean, that's what it's all about at the end of the day.
Steve, you're nodding. You're nodding and nodding and nodding. What is changing these systems?
Can I respond first to that question?
Yeah.
Because how that strikes me is it's the same thing as putting a pile of wood next to somebody and then coming back a week later. And that's the only thing you've given them. And then coming back a week later and saying, why haven't you built a house? People need tools and they need access to treatment. And without that, they stay stuck in the cycle of addiction. So until we meet the crisis at the same level that it exists, we're not going to change it.
Let me talk about that. You said the cycle of addiction. So what are we talking about, people who are not beginning but who have been in the cycle for years? Are the deaths that we're seeing people who – these are not people who started using yesterday.
It's hard to say. I would say mostly not. But this epidemic is hitting people younger and younger. Most of the young people that we see at the center started using when they were 14 years old, opiates.
Hmm.
So that's high school. The progression of somebody using opiates is very rapid. So usually their life falls apart completely by the time they're 18 or 19.
So that's so young. I mean, we know so much about the teenage brain. We've heard so much about the ability to make good decisions when you're 14 years old.
Right. And when you're in the active cycle of addiction, rational thought is not part of that. So expecting someone to have rational thought when they're in the middle of an active addiction is unrealistic. You can't expect someone to make rational choices when their brains are basically hijacked by a chemical.
And just one point to add to Steve's comments is that, you know, fentanyl's really changed the game, right? So you could be using opioids for 10 years and know exactly what you need and how you're going to need it and when you're going to take it in order to survive and not get sick. But when you mix fentanyl into those equations, all rules are gone. All bets are off. So you could be somebody who's been suffering from a disorder for a long, long time, or somebody who's picked it up for the first time and they're using fentanyl. Dr. Feller's talked about micrograms. Think about grains of salt. Really, we're talking about really, really small amounts of this that can kill you one time. It doesn't take 20 times. It could be one time.
Where is the fentanyl coming from? Is it something that is manufactured in labs right here in Maine? Is this coming from another place?
Yeah, so for fentanyl, so that's a synthetic opioid, right? So that's man-made. And most of the fentanyl that we see in the state of Maine is coming from Mexico. And ultimately, it's following the traditional drug routes up the 95 corridor and into the state of Maine after primarily for us stopping off in drug centers in Massachusetts or Connecticut or New York.
On the line with us now, Bill Burns. He's Health Services Director at Preble Street in Portland. Bill, thanks for calling in.
Thank you for having us.
Bill, you work with people who have the double challenge of homelessness and substance abuse. How bad is the situation right now?
Yeah, we would call this it's an epidemic. I think from a public health perspective, we are in extremely dangerous waters. The number of overdoses we're seeing at Preble Street have already passed last year's total. In fact, the rate of overdoses is twice what it was in 2016. So we're seeing an overdose about one every 8 days.
Oh, my gosh. For those who are homeless, what are some of the added obstacles to getting help or fighting opioid abuse?
Right. I mean, as Dr. Fellers kind of talked about and can talk at greater length about, the distribution of slots in treatment programs is not really effectively reaching homeless folks. For example, if people wanted to detox today, if someone was homeless and wanted to detox today, there would most likely be no slot for them. At Milestone, the local kind of detox agency, they turn away 100 people every month. So one of our biggest concerns is that people will die, homeless people will die while waiting to get into treatment. Again, the lack of a kind of broader public health response means that what we're left with is a band of committed social workers with Narcan, and it's just not enough to respond to this epidemic.
If we were able to open more treatment centers, if we had all this money coming in, are there even enough trained people to run them? And I mean, how far are we away from, even if money were not an object, Dr. Fellers, from being where we need to be as far as treatment?
So, you know, I'm an addiction psychiatrist. I'm quite specialized, and our health system doesn't have many experts like me, and Maine doesn't have many experts like me. And so there's been a big push recently to expand buprenorphine training to primary care physicians. and also to...
Let me stop you right there because I don't think we've talked about that. Buprenorphine training. Tell me what that is and why
sure.
that's important.
So the treatment for opioid use disorder, by and large, is medication-assisted treatment. The outcomes with medication-assisted treatment, it's night and day differences. So people are able to be retained in treatment and show abstinence and show all sorts of positive outcomes, including decreased mortality from methadone, which is a synthetic opioid, which is a pretty powerful but very inexpensive opioid that substitutes, and it's a harm reduction strategy. It's tightly regulated by the DEA, can only be administered in a methadone clinic, and patients have to show up every single day to be observed taking the medication so that none of it is diverted into the community. Because it is dangerous. People can overdose on it. Buprenorphine is a newer, it's kind of like the new kid on the block, although it's really been around for about 15 years. But it's also a synthetic opiate. And what it does is it's a partial agonist, which is a fancy way of saying it activates the receptors but doesn't activate them 100%, more like maybe 20 to 40%. And what that does is it binds very tightly to the receptor, so tightly that if someone were taking buprenorphine and tried to get high by taking heroin or fentanyl, it wouldn't be able to displace the buprenorphine off the receptor, and so they wouldn't really feel it. And in some ways, that can facilitate extinction learning so that they learn that it's not worth it to keep on trying.
Mm. So you were saying that you're trying to train more primary care
exactly.
physicians.
So, you know, what we're looking at is, you know, it's great that I'm here and, you know, I have this acute service. The problem is this is a chronic condition, and it's a chronic relapsing condition, like a lot of other diseases like diabetes, like hypertension. And once we start someone on medication treatment, they need to be maintained on that medication treatment. And I have so much capacity myself, and I need to be able to send them somewhere else so that they can be maintained. And I see it like any other chronic medical condition, and I'm hoping that my colleagues in primary care will also accept this as a primary condition and something that they feel comfortable dealing with as well. Mm. And so that's where the capacity really comes in the system.
Bill, before I let you go, I want to ask you, do you see any signs of hope?
Yeah, I mean, I think Dr. Fellers and his colleagues at MaineMed, I think they understand the complexity of this condition and the need for an integrated approach to care. However, until we, abandon this understanding of this disease process as a moral failure and start addressing it as a public health crisis, we're just going to keep recycling the same thing. In terms of increasing the capacity of people who can prescribe buprenorphine, I mean, that's a huge part of the equation. Less than 1% of emergency room physicians are trained to provide buprenorphine, and that's a golden opportunity to start people in treatment. So it's a big challenge to get more people certified, and I'm encouraged every day to see more and more doctors getting that certification.
Bill, thanks so much for calling in. Bill Burns is Health Services Director at Preble Street. And we do have to take a quick break. We're talking about the opioid epidemic. We hope you'll stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Bill Blumenreich Presents, offering an evening with astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, September 27th at Merrill Auditorium. Tickets at porttix.com.
Schools and hospitals have long been off limits for tracking down and arresting undocumented immigrants. But in Texas, federal agents have entered hospitals while families are dealing with sick relatives.
It violates human decency. You don't interrupt medical procedures.
I'm Elsa Chang. That story plus all the day's news this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered every weekday afternoon from 4 to 6:30 on Maine Public Radio. Part 4 of filmmaker Ken Burns' The Vietnam War is on this evening at 8 on Maine Public Television. Tonight's episode, Resolve. Defying American air power, North Vietnamese troops and materiel stream down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, while Saigon struggles to pacify the countryside. As an anti-war movement builds at home, GIs discover that this war is nothing like their father's war. The Vietnam War is on each evening this week and next, Sunday through Thursday at 8, with a repeat immediately following. Tonight's repeat is at 10 o'clock on Maine Public Television.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Fighting the Opioid Crisis in Maine. With me in the studio, Steve Coutreau, Program Manager with Portland Recovery Community Center. Jonathan Fellers, Addiction Psychiatrist and Medical Director of Integrated Medication-Assisted Treatment at Maine Med. And Mike Soscheck, the Portland Police Chief. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now, Ricker Hamilton. He is Acting Commissioner of Maine's Department of Health and Human Services. Commissioner Hamilton, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for your invitation.
Ricker, what are some of the measures that the state of Maine has taken to help address the opioid crisis recently?
In 2017 alone, spending for opioid treatment for the crisis was around $20 million. One of the major components of that is $2.8 million that has gone into creating the opioid health homes. Maine really is at the forefront of that. In a recent call last week with state health offices, they were amazed at the rollout time, the low rollout time we had taking and putting that in place. It's pretty impressive. We've had four agencies providing that service, and we have 16 more applications coming in. Of the four agencies, there's seven sites that are doing that as well.
What is that, a health home?
It's very similar to what the providers in Maine are used to with our behavioral health homes and health homes in general, where someone's care is the whole care, the whole person is treated together rather than receiving, for example, your addiction therapy someplace else. You're getting primary care physicians and is tied together in working with providers. It's an evidence-based approach, which we've seen is showing us the best results.
Do you believe progress is being made?
Oh, I think so. We've done so much, and there's more to do, and it takes all of us to move the needle on this. But we've increased, for example, the medication-assisted therapy slots for the uninsured have increased by 500 slots. The intensive outpatient and opioid treatment and other services, we've increased that capacity by about 1,000 slots as well. Also very, very excited. You've probably seen that on the PMP, the Prescription Monitoring Program. Maine really has taken off since the LD passed and is a leader in that area. Just seeing the decrease in the prescriptions and the amount of equivalents that are coming, Maine, it's just exciting. So things never happen fast enough for those of us who need this treatment, and we need to stay together as a team to do that. But there is a lot of positive things going on, as well as, I think if you spoke with the sheriff up at Penobscot County, the Vivitrol program that we're doing there at the county jail, although it's a pilot, I think it's promising.
Ricker, what would you say to those who criticize the state, say the state is not doing enough in terms of allocating funds or resources for, I think the term that's been used is dragging its feet?
Yeah, well, you know, the department is a very easy target. I think that those comments would be uninformed and unfortunate. We're a very active partner in this. All of the money that we're getting appropriated by the legislature is getting out as fast as we can. We do it as fast as we can within state rules. We're also looking to our federal partners and getting millions of dollars also from our federal partners to help this. So, yeah, every day in the position I'm in, I hear that. I just hope that that people know that this is a serious problem. It takes adults to deal with it. And instead of pointing fingers and shaking heads, I just like to have comments that are backed up by facts and stuff. This is too serious. The people who are dying from this, the families who are dealing with it, those of us who are dealing with this need to all work together rather than pointing fingers. That doesn't work. I guess ends up in the print media quite a bit, but in the long run, it doesn't help all of us. More importantly, the people we're trying to serve.
Commissioner Hamilton, thank you for joining us today. Ricker Hamilton, the Acting Commissioner of the Maine Department of Health and Human Services. Also now on the line with us, Mary Ann Roy, Chief Clinical Officer at Crossroads, a behavioral health and addiction treatment center based in Scarborough. Mary Ann, tell us what you do at Crossroads and how it's different than some other organizations.
Sure. Thank you for having me on the radio today. Crossroads has been around since 1974, and we specialize in the gender-responsive treatment for addiction and behavioral health services. We have two outpatient locations in Kennebunk and Scarborough, where we provide addiction and behavioral health treatment, individual group therapy, family therapy, One of the things that we're most known for here in the state, though, is our women's residential program. We have two women's primary treatment residential programs for addiction. We're most known for our Children and Mothers program out in our Windham area. That is a program that's up to 60 days. It's primary treatment for women coming in seeking help for their addiction. They can come in at any stage of their pregnancy into this program, and we have 5 beds reserved for women bringing in children 0 to 5.
What is your waiting list?
You know, that program can vary. Sometimes it can be a couple of weeks. Sometimes, you know, if we can't get a hold of people on the wait list, it can move a little bit quicker. But our Children and Mothers program typically could have a wait list of up to a few weeks, but that can certainly vary. We also have a Back Cove Women's Residential Program in the Portland area. Both of our residential programs are for women 18 and up, and they specialize in the specific needs of women. We really place a strong focus and emphasis on how women and men differ in terms of their addiction process as well as their recovery. So that's a very unique feature to the Crossroads residential programming.
Well, Marianne, thanks for joining us today. Marianne Roy, Chief Clinical Officer at Crossroads Treatment Center. I'm going to go to a call from Eli. Eli's calling from Elliott because, Eli, I think you want to talk about something we were actually talking about during the break. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about this idea that, you know, there just has to be more buprenorphine treatment. And while I think, you know, it's definitely a tool in the toolbox, it's not, you know, it's not the end all and be all. There's plenty of people who are on buprenorphine maintenance treatment and want a way to get off, and there's no real easy way to get off. And you have to remember that if you're being maintained on buprenorphine or Suboxone or, you know, whatever you want to call it, you're still addicted to an opioid. And, you know, in fact, the withdrawal from buprenorphine is pretty terrible as well. So,
yeah, thanks for calling. And this is to touch on something we were talking about, Steve. We were talking about buprenorphine as you said, the new kid on the block, even though it's not that new, Dr. Fellers. But it really isn't the only way.
No, there are many, many people that are abstinent, not on medication, in recovery, successful. It's, I think it's not the argument for us to have. I think it's an individual choice, and someone has to follow the treatment that they believe in and that they want to follow. It's not for us to judge what someone's medical treatment is. It's to support them in their recovery.
Are there odds, Dr. Fellers, of how many people do well using something like buprenorphine or methadone versus not?
Yeah, there's a robust scientific data that supports the use of medication-assisted treatment. However, that doesn't mean everybody needs to do medication-assisted treatment. When they look at detox, so just someone with opioid dependence who goes to a detox facility, the outcomes are very poor right afterwards. There's one study that takes a look at this, and on the day of discharge, 29% relapse. Within that first month, 60% relapse. And at the year point, there's data that suggests between 5 and 10% are successful in staying sober after just a detox and drug-free treatment. Now, that's not supported with other stuff like going to an intensive treatment program, attending 12-step meetings. That's just the natural course for all comers who come to a detox facility. When they compare that to so there's some trials where they've compared placebo to one of these medication-assisted treatment options. And when they do that, the outcomes are very similar, meaning the retention in treatment, the people who keep on coming back in that research trial and they receive the placebo arm is very, very poor. Barely any are still in treatment or doing well or remaining sober at the six-month mark. But if they were randomized to the buprenorphine arm or the naltrexone arm or the methadone arm, the treatment outcomes are vastly different. So for methadone, pretty robust data that 60 to 70% of clients who start on methadone will be retained in treatment at a year. And so if you compare 5 to 10% to 60 to 70%, it's really quite remarkable, the difference. And for buprenorphine, you see similar numbers. And in real practice, in kind of the model that MaineHealth is adopting, it's at least 50% retention in treatment, doing well at a year mark. And, you know, numbers like that inform our guidance that basically if someone has opioid use disorder, we would be doing a disservice if we did not offer medication-assisted treatment. Like, we have to offer it. Patient can choose what they want, but with data that's compelling, we need to be able to offer it for people.
We have a post from Gary on Facebook. There are only so many roads coming into Maine. Why not choke off the supply? Sure, it's a huge task, but all hands on deck. Chief Soschuk?
You know, the enforcement aspect of this is something that we've been working on for a long, long time, obviously, with the various forms of the failed war on drugs. And I've talked about that a great deal. I think there's a lot of great professionals that are out there that are trying to do just that without greatly impacting the constitutional rights of our citizens. And we just need to remember that enforcement is a part of the equation. It shouldn't be the leading aspect of this equation. We do have to focus on prevention. We do have to focus on treatment. And I do think we need to increase our enforcement as well. I think that makes perfect sense. And, you know, to jump in on our last question there, you know, as a layperson that's been looking at this for the last few years, I just think it's incredibly important that we remember that we need to meet people where they're at that particular time and work with them. Because there are folks out there that are doing yoga and meditation works for them, and abstinence works for somebody else. But
acupuncture.
That, yeah, but that toolbox has to be full. And the data is very, very strong around MAT and medically assisted treatment. And that has to be an option as a part of this equation. And intensive outpatient. And the simple fact is that a treatment across the board is lacking across the board, across the country, certainly here in the state of Maine and certainly in the city of Portland, despite a lot of folks working really hard to increase that level.
How expensive is medication assisted treatment, and do most insurance carriers cover it?
So methadone is actually very cheap. Most of the clinics in town, it's about $90 to $95 a week, and that includes the medication, the counseling, the administration of the medication, everything. So $360 a month or so. For buprenorphine, commonly the medication alone is probably about $5,000 to $6,000 a year. And then there's the additional office visits and the toxicology screening. So bringing that up to $7,500, $10,000 a year.
I think it's important to remember, you know, we talk about insurance. If people lack insurance, they lack options around that world, $360 will break your back. Mm-hmm. You know, in most cases, folks, their entire world has been shattered by the point that they get to this level where they're getting that monthly treatment. So where's that money coming from? And what's their rate of success if, in fact, they don't have access to that? What's going to happen to them? Well, what's going to happen is we see these fatality rates where they are. And that's why this is a crisis today. So it has to be addressed at a multitude of levels, and a lack of insurance is certainly a major part of that conversation in my mind.
We have an email here from Elson that I think speaks to that multiple levels. I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's long. Real successful solutions won't come from government agencies, this person writes. It's very clear what's been done in the past and what's being done is not enough. It's not working. One, look at what is missing in our communities, in our schools, in our parenting of young people. Society is failing them. Do you agree, Steve?
Wow. That's a loaded question. So I don't think blanket statements generally work. I think there are very good parents out there. I think that there's a combination here. Pharmaceutical. I think that for whatever reason, the drug that's available to young people is now heroin. You know, how we got there, I think could be a whole show in itself, but that's where we're at.
Well, we do have to take another short break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Jade Integrated Health. Collaborative acupuncture, physical therapy, massage, and yoga in Portland and Brunswick. jadeintegratedhealth.com.
On the next Fresh Air, a Harvard professor reflects on the life and tragic death of her younger cousin. Danielle Allen's cousin Michael was arrested for the first time at 15 when tough sentencing laws were driven by the war on drugs. He spent 11 years in prison and was shot to death 3 years after his release. Allen's new memoir is also a critique of the justice system. Join us.
You can hear Fresh Air tonight at 7 on Maine Public Radio. And stay with us after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock for a special from the BBC called The Engineers, The Rise of the Robots. You can hear that at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling on listener-supported Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, The Opioid Crisis in Maine. Joining me today, Mike Soschuk, Portland Police Chief, Steve Coutreau with the Portland Recovery Community Center, and Dr. Jonathan Fellers, addiction psychiatrist at Maine Medical Center. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Before the break, we were talking about Elson's email. It says, society is failing young people. Chief Soschuk.
Yeah, something that I look at when I think about and talk about it, that three-legged stool of prevention, treatment, and enforcement is that we spend all of our time focused on in treatment and enforcement because of the nature of the crisis. You know, people are dying, so we're focusing on the real time. What are we going to do today? But the simple fact is that at some point, if we don't focus on the front end of this, if we don't shut off the spigot, we don't focus on prevention, then in fact that will never slow down on the back half. So a piece of that is talking to families about, you know, if you're having a conversation about substance use in the sixth grade, have it in the third grade. I'm sorry to tell you, but it needs to happen earlier, the better. And it does have to happen at schools. It has to be right in our face on a regular basis. And maybe parents talked about and still talk about, so do you have alcohol in the home? Do you have a pool in the backyard? Talking about safety when their kids go over. Start asking about, do you have opioids? Do you have prescription medications that are unsecured in your bathroom or someplace in your house? Let's have those tough conversations earlier the better so that we can, in fact, again, be part of that equation and ultimately save lives.
You're all nodding. Dr. Fellers.
Yeah, prevention is a key part to this. And the opioid epidemic did not develop in a vacuum. There were a lot of other factors that the emailer alludes to. And one of the chief factors where you see the opioid epidemic is most acute is in rural areas where there has been a loss of opportunity or a lack of ability to, really get ahead in the world. And, you know, opioids are powerful medications. They treat a lot of symptoms. They treat, pain, but they also treat depression, anxiety. They do they treat emotional pain. They treat, a lack of opportunity. They treat things.
Ronnie Bossy is on the phone with us now. He's chair of Recovery Aroostook, based at Cary Medical Center in Caribou. Ronnie, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Feller's just talking about rural areas of Maine. You are in a much more remote part of the state than we are sitting here in Portland. How bad is the opioid problem in Aroostook County, and how are you dealing with it?
Yeah, it definitely is a much more rural area. I moved up here recently from Portland, and a couple of things really stood out to me. One, the level of the issue, and two, for lack of a better term, lack of services, which a number of people have already mentioned. It's definitely an issue. I think we had something like, as other people have probably mentioned earlier in the program, I want to say like 378 overdoses last year alone in Maine. And as Chief Soschuk was mentioning, this isn't an issue that we're able to arrest our way out of. It really does need to be treated as a health issue and a recovery issue second. But it tends to be looked at as much more of a moral issue. So public perception can be somewhat of a challenge because, if you're a relative that has cancer, there's no behavioral issues associated with that. There's no kind of a moral issue associated with that. So as they should be, they're treated very, very well. When an addict in need and crisis tends not to be viewed quite the same way. So changing public perception on that tends to be an uphill battle. One of the things that I'm seeing up here is people are not only aware of, you know, the level of the issue, unfortunately, by way of deaths, really, but there's also a good number of people that are getting together and want to actually take some action around this, just not sure what to do. So, you know, in May 11th in Caribou, we had a town hall style meeting to try to bring some awareness to this issue and to try to raise some questions. You know, what is it that we can do to help to kind of address this and to offer help, right? So as a result of that meeting, something like 30 or 40 of us roughly got together and formed this group, Recovery Aroostook, just to try to come up with, you know, promoting awareness for one, to find out what services are currently here, not only in Aroostook County, but throughout the state, because, you know, the reality is sometimes we just need to tap into other resources to get the help.
What is it about your group that helps people succeed?
Yeah, so we formed right after the town hall meeting in May 11th. We've been going for a few months now, and we're focusing on a couple of different things. One of the things that we're actually in steps to make it happen is a sober living home. So it's basically a place where people can, you know, and there's others in the state, but a place where people can go newly sober after their sort of acute medical attention and just live. So it's really an apartment for a safe apartment for people to go and live, to be in an environment that they need to be in that's conducive to actually, you know, recovering from this. I mean, as other people mentioned, you know, as medical detox is one thing, but like, what are you going to do after that, right? So the other thing that we're focusing on, so that's actually going to be opened November 1st, and that's called Allen's Way. So there, as of now, if you want to find out more information about it, there's a Facebook page and some contact information there, and it's called Allen's Way. The other thing that we're focusing on, have a building, we're in the steps of getting this going, is a recovery center. You know, so we're trying to create services up here that there are in other parts of the state, in other parts of the country. The wonderful thing is that people from all capacities of the community, you know, whether it's members of the recovery community, a district attorney, Cary Medical Center, AMHC, you know, several different capacities are coming together to ask what can I do to help, right? So, you know, when more people come together like that, and they've been pretty consistent.
Great.
Things start to happen.
So. Great. Well, Ronnie Bossy, I thank you so much for calling in. He is with Recovery Aroostook, which is based at Cary Medical Center in Caribou. You know, something Ronnie said, Steve, reminded me of something I heard on another project I was working on, where the mother of somebody who was addicted to opioids said, "When my son went into recovery, nobody brought me a cake. Nobody brought me dinner." How right. important is it to support, to, one, not pass a moral judgment, but then also to support the families?
So it's I think, often overlooked that it's not just those of us that have substance use disorder that suffer. It's also the family, and the whole family gets sick. And so the whole family has to heal as well. And there are great support groups. There's one at the recovery center for families, for affected others. But it's very important to support the family and you know, save the judgment and just support them, because their loved one is suffering.
Would you say if you know someone or you've heard of someone, reach out?
Absolutely. Reach out. Even if you don't know what to say, just offer support. Just listen. Let them talk, and just as you would with anything else.
We'll go to Lindsay, who's calling from Searsport. Hi, Lindsay. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just listening on my way to pick up my daughter from school. And recently, in February, my fiancé passed away of an overdose. And, I mean, he was clean for 4 years. And relapsed in June of the year prior, and went to Milestone for a week, which was great because he was great when he came home. But the same old, you know, the addiction came back. The only thing with him was when he was on Suboxone prior to relapsing, it was just too expensive. I mean, we have two kids, you know, bills. And that's when he was like, I'm just going to go cold turkey off of it, off of Suboxone. And I feel like that's what led us to being where, you know, him passing away.
Oh, Lindsay, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. You know, the price of the medication, you know, Maine Medical Center, we provide a lot of uncompensated care. And one of the major costs that we're not really able to cover is the pharmacy part of it. So even though we're able to see patients and provide care, they still have to pay for the medication. And like the caller said, that can be a choice of, you know, putting food on the table or paying for this life-saving medication. And it's a serious challenge. You know, the pharmaceutical companies do offer a limited pharmaceutical assistance program. Each prescriber can have three free participants on one of the formulations. And so the more prescribers we have out there, the more they can take they can actually use that free medication to for us.
Lindsay, thank you for calling and sharing your story. And again, I'm so sorry. We'll go to Ed, who's calling from Hollowell. Hi, Ed. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you doing? Great show, Jennifer. I spent a lot of my career in public health dealing with nicotine addiction here in Maine through my work at the Lung Association. And I'm concerned about the prevention piece. The chief was talking about this before. And my question is pretty basic. Do we really know what works for prevention? And because the public health history is littered with efforts that people thought were a good idea and actually ended up having pretty poor unintended consequences there. And for example, as we crack down on prescription drugs, are we in fact potentially driving people out into the streets where the drug that they're getting is with fentanyl and other things? So I'd be curious if there's not a good best practice for prevention, are we doing the kind of research we need to do to prevent this problem?
And Ed, what you're talking about is Maine's stricter law now about physicians prescribing opioids. And Stephen, you're nodding away.
Well, we saw that in the early 2000s when there was such a crackdown on OxyContin. So at that time, I was running a methadone clinic, and probably 90% of the people that came in were using prescription medication or abusing it. And that number is completely flipped after a severe crackdown in the probably mid-2000s around prescription medication. And addiction, you can't make the vacuum go away. Addiction, if it exists, has to be treated. You can't just take away the substance and the addiction is gone.
Chief, let's talk about the first part of Ed's question. Do we know it works?
It's a great question. I know there's a lot of folks that are out there really working on a solid model because it is interesting. And Ed speaks to, as an example, the DARE program for a long, long time was in full effect, and that was the best practice, and then and I don't even know the backstory behind. All of a sudden, it was persona non grata, and it was nobody. You don't teach DARE anymore. And you know, you talk about just say no to drugs, and then looking back at that as a platform for a national program, and how ineffective and actually harmful that approach was for substance use in general. So I think we do have to find a solid program that professionals can agree is effective. But the simple fact is that has to happen. If we're not comfortable with what we have now, then we have to get something that we can use and then everybody can use. And everybody should know. It should be on the tip of our tongues.
You said that start talking to kids earlier and earlier and earlier. Dr. Fellers, if you have an 8-year-old in front of you, a 10-year-old, what do you say to them?
Well, tell them the truth that, you know, opioids are powerful medications. You know, they have some approved medical uses, but at the same time, they have a lot of risks. And we, you know, the medical community has not recognized the risks for a while. We used to know it. When I was growing up, I remember it was really hard to get a Tylenol number 3. Like, you know, I broke my arm and it was like, oh, I got a Tylenol number 3. That was like a heavy thing back then. And then more recently, you know, our perception of pain medicines and the danger of them has changed. You know, it's not everybody probably has a story of going to the doctor and getting 60 oxycodone after a minor little thing. I think we need to educate our children that, you know, these medications are dangerous, that they're just because they're prescription does not mean that they're safe.
All right. Well, that's going to be the last word today. I'm going to ask all three of you to provide me with resources to put on the Maine Calling Facebook page. That was Dr. Jonathan Fellers, Medical Director of Maine Medical Center's Integrated Medication-Assisted Treatment. He's also Assistant Clinical Professor with Tufts University School of Medicine. Michael Soschuk is Chief of Police for the City of Portland. I understand the Chief of the Year for 2017 in Maine. Stephen Coutru is Program Manager for the Portland Recovery Community Center. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.